Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Once again, Audrey, thank you so much for getting us tuned up and on to the show on time. My not-so-nimble fingers did hit another number on the dashboard, and I'm showing instead of a plus two, a plus 27. So I hope we're broadcasting live to people out there, and that didn't mess anything up. But anyway, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, as Audrey said. And we want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us across the country in that marvelous trip to 90 different cities and states. And what a song to be able to sing from memory without looking at a thing when he sings those lyrics. A tough song to learn. Emily and Mike, thank you very much. We got some special things going on tonight. We got wires across our performance desk here like I've never seen before. Some of that I might explain later, but... Probably there's no need to really do it. It's some of the tech side stuff, and Mike handles most of that. The purpose of the show is what it always is. Each week, we try to discuss news, issues, events, and significant developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice, and it does get humorous now and then. Our show is dedicated to all those people that work in the prison system, the court system, at the the police system at federal, state, local levels, international levels for that matter, of course. And they do a marvelous job for us, and I guess the proof is in, the pudding? And we do have, for the last two or three years, the lowest crime rates we've had in 50 years, and we can thank that a lot of people, including the Criminal Justice Professoriate, who came up with that marvelous discovery after the sociologists and criminologists studied for years. The criminal justice professors came along, and you know what they found out? If you lock up the bad guys, the crime rate goes down. What a discovery. Almost knocked me off my seat when I first heard it. So we try to look inside, take a close-up look at criminal justice and professionals. Tonight's going to be very special. I can't withhold my enthusiasm for this. Once again, we're going to draw off of C-SPAN.org and BookTV.org and the other section that's on there, the podcast. Not the videos. You don't see a video with these. Just click on podcast when you go to booktv.org. It's part of the BookTV business. And tonight we're going to have Joan Biskupic. Yes, that's right. I know her. She's a Supreme Court reporter. Joan Biskupic. And she'll be talking about an American original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And Scalia is quite a personality, and she's written a biography. Biographers have a tough job. You know, they, first of all, they can't please everybody. Most of the time, they certainly want to please the person they're doing the biography on, and I'm sure she's done that. But this, when you hear about Justice Scalia and his many and varied interests and what he came from and how hard he has worked, I think you'll be really impressed with, politics aside, the kind of person that this Supreme Court justice is. And of course, this is the week that we're nominating, or has been nominated, Elena Kagan, and looks like she's going to be confirmed probably tomorrow or sometime this week. So we're adding another woman to the United States Supreme Court. That will be interesting. This is the Blog Talk Radio Network. Blog Talk Radio is a leading technology, believe me. Alan Levy, he's the CEO of BTR and the genius behind the medium, as I'm fond of saying. And we now know that Blog Talk Radio is topping out in the top 100 websites in the entire world. And if you go look at the show billings, I mean, how many shows are there on there now? I think somebody said 75,000 different episodes are now archived on there. And anyway, any person, any interest group, any organization can have their own network. I'm surprised. I've got to look. I think some universities have actually gone up there and started classes, but I wouldn't just swear to it. But it's possible. It's free. And it all seems to work very well. I mean, we've been doing this, what, 19 years? No, not quite that many. 4 years. And we started out pretty early when there weren't very many shows. And these shows are archived immediately after the show. You can download them, play them. There's no copyright violation. You know, put them on your player and MP3 player and play them later, whatever you want to do. Use them for classroom instruction. Click them, cite them on the web with a link and have your students look at them. We have people do that cross country. They do that with our show once in a while. So if you don't like what we do, you know what we're fond of saying, get your own show. You can do whatever you like. I told you tonight what the show's about. It's about Justice Scalia. I think you'll be very pleased with that. If you want to call in during the news segment of the show, our call-in number is 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. And, Mike, do not let that guy call in again that's trying to tell us the security system. Have you heard him? He calls in, he goes, would you like to buy the security system? He sounds like that. And then he wants your credit card number. So we're not talking to him. I thought we had those kind of things weeded out, but they still get through. Well, Audrey, of course, has a blonde joke tonight. And, Audrey, I took a little peek on the production desk there, and I saw this is a little series of jokes tonight. Am I right? A little one-liners, and there's some really good ones in here. So, Audrey, in case you don't know, ladies and gentlemen, is a collector of blonde jokes, and she's been doing it for since she was a child. She is from London, England, and she is a blonde. So here she goes with tonight's series of blonde jokes, some one-liners. Audrey, go ahead.
Professor Haley, tonight we have a series of blonde joke one-liners, and Mike and Emily both think every one of them is funny. Here we go. I hope our audience enjoys them. She sent me a fax with a stamp on it. She thought a quarterback was refund. She tried to put amandums in alphabetical order. She thought boys, two men was a daycare center. She thought his pocket was a set of garden tools. She thought General Motors was in the army. She thought Meowmix was a CD for cats. She thought Tupac Shakur was a Jewish holiday. Under education on her job application, she put hooked on phonics. She tried to drown a fish. She tripped over a cordless phone. She spent 20 minutes looking at the orange juice can, because it said concentrate. She got stabbed in a shootout. She told me to meet her at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk. They had to burn the school down to get her out of third grade. She asked for a price check at the dollar store. It takes her 2 hours to watch 60 minutes.
All right. Thank you very much, Audrey. And see, our audience liked it. You could tell from their applause. Ladies and gentlemen, people were betting tonight based on the McDonald versus Chicago Supreme Court decision that tonight's show would be called something like with liberty and guns for all, because the Supreme Court, I'll talk about that later, has finally ruled that the Second Amendment applies to everybody, that the due process clause of the 14th Amendment picks up the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms and applies it to people throughout the United States. And that is absolutely great. And with liberty and guns for all would have been a good title, but that is also the title of one of my books. And I think there are several million copies left on Amazon.com if you care to look. And the cover, by the way, I designed the cover for that book. Most publishers don't let you do that, but I designed that one. But anyway, on a much more serious note, relative to guns, the Ohio Gun Coalition has a public service announcement. They're playing for the criminals, and they want them to hear this announcement, take their firearms, and go turn them in. So go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And carrying those guns is certainly a deadly idea. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in order to promote the sustaining of the planet, you know, it's global warming could overwhelm us at any point. In time, and there's so many things that add to the sitting temperature of the planet. And I know one of those things, we're trying to preserve things and conserve our energy, and the fewer trees we grow and that type of thing. See, are trees good or bad? No, trees are good, but it's just animals are bad, that's right. We try to pass on a green tip each week, and last week we varied a little bit. We didn't use one of Esma Floyd's tips from her book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And hey, there's a subtitle to that I just noticed. Small Changes to Create a Greener, Eco-Friendly World. There you go. That explains it even more. But tonight we're going to use tip number 916. Now, this is a good one. I'll give everyone time to get a pencil to write this down. It says, don't picnic on plastic. Don't take plastic utensils on picnics. Instead, use old mugs and plates from your own home, or you can go buy a set from a charity shop or some type of garage sale, and you can just keep those for picnics. Metal cutlery can be wrapped in a dish towel to stop it from clunking around. So in other words, let's don't keep using paper plates and plastic utensils and things like that, throwing them away. We don't need to do that. We could be carrying our dishes around or with us, our metal utensils and our ceramic plates or whatever. So there you go. That sounds like a good tip. And Mike, I noticed you didn't write that down. Okay. We'll just... All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a look at the news tonight. And some of it is absolutely incredible. And it always is. And there's a lot more to it than we'll be able to get to this evening. But we'll go ahead and try some of these news stories and see what you think about those. You know, we finally got a report. Are you tired of this as much as I am? Remember the professor at in Cambridge, or the police officer, Sergeant Crowley, came to the call because someone reported that Professor Gates was trying to break into a home because he couldn't get in, so he had... Professor Gates was arrested on disorderly conduct last July 16th. It's been a whole year. I've been wishing it was longer. While the Sergeant James Crowley investigated a call about a possible burglary at the Gates home, the 9/11 call came after Professor Gates and a driver tried to open his jammed front door. The professor said he was a victim of racial profiling, and then those charges were later dropped. Remember, President Obama said that what the officer did, I think it was something on the order, was stupid. And, you know, something I've never heard about that case is somebody calls and says there's a burglary going on, and you see the guys there with the bars, a pry bar, trying to get in the place. Of course, you check it out, and you check for ID and that type of thing. And apparently he did show them some Harvard type of ID. But, you know, there's another issue there. I think I mentioned it one other time at a radio show. And that is that sometimes people have the keys to the house, and they list the house as their address, but there might be a court order against them being there. You know, they could be a family trouble situation where they have warrants against them, or they're not supposed to, you know, they're supposed to be out of the house and not to return. So the sergeant could have been investigating that. But President Obama had him down for beers, and apparently he said that both of them had something to learn, but they formed a commission. Says here, well, this thing here is not just about race, says Chuck Waxman. He's chairman of the committee and executive director. This is about something else as well. You can't take race off the table. You can't take class off the table. And you can't take police authority off the table. Maybe not close to brilliant, but close. But this encounter is much more about the relationship that these two individuals had, which I don't think they had any to start with. Charles Ogletree, a law professor at Harvard who represented Professor Gates, he said in an interview he applauded the committee for forward-looking recommendations but felt numerous facts were omitted. It's comprehensive and positive and moving in the right direction, but I find quite troubling that the early overview of the incident leaves out essential, critical, and dispositive information about what happened on the 16th. Sergeant Crowley, in a statement, he said that he learned a lot through this process. He continues to be committed to the city of Cambridge. What they said that both of them could have, they missed opportunities to ratchet down this particular situation. And, you know, whatever, they're probably on a, I mean, I'm not a total police apologist, but whatever in a circumstance like that, the police didn't do the right thing, right? Now, if the cop would have not done anything, they'd probably been wrong for that, too. But anyway, that's an interesting little situation, and I hope this is the end of it after a year-long commission has studied this particular problem. So that's the Sergeant Crowley story. I don't know much about this, but it gets more and more interesting. I saw the front page of the Inquirer magazine this morning, and I think you probably saw that former Vice President Gore, has been charged now, a woman has made a complaint, has been charged with a sexual assault. She was a masseuse that was called to his room and out on the West Coast. And apparently he did things with her and had her do things that the family show, I know, that he shouldn't have been doing. So that is something that we'll have to follow, and they refiled these charges. And what they said in the Inquirer, you know, not always the most astute and the accurate source for information, but what the Inquirer said was that the hotel apparently has a video, a secret camera inside the hotel room. Now, isn't that incredible? So that fits in with an interest I have about being taped all over the place with video, and you don't know that it's going on. But anyway, I don't have much more to say about that. We'll have to see what happens. But they did reopen the case, and if this is in Portland. This is a Portland massage therapist. You know, she didn't want to report the case originally. Her friends told her not to report Al Gore because it would damage the movement to save the planet. I'm not kidding. As described, she said her liberal friends advised her that. A spokesman for Mr. Gore said he unequivocally and emphatically denied making unwanted sexual advances for the woman. That isn't what the woman says. And she called him a number of things, which I won't repeat on the air. But very, very interesting to see what's going to happen in that particular probe. Here's another one that's kind of interesting. You think college students ought to have criminal background checks? You know, we've had shootings across the United States. Campuses are still some of the safest places to be, but there's a big to-do going on now about whether or not we ought to have all incoming college freshmen go through a criminal background check, and some schools are doing it. They're making them go through a background check, and then if they have criminal records, they're not going to be admitted to the university, but it's really in a state of flux right now. Some people support that idea, and other people think that probing students' past is not appropriate at all. So what do you think? It's going to be interesting. Gun bans on campus. People are saying this isn't going to, the McDonald versus Chicago case is not going to be a Supreme Court's decision this past week. It's not going to affect that gun bans will still be illegal. And, of course, you know, after this case came out, Mayor Daley, because his town was the city was the object of the suit, You can't have a handgun in Chicago. He said they're going to reformulate their law right away. They'll probably do exactly what Washington, D.C. did after D.C. versus Heller, that case. And what they did is create a whole bunch of hoops that somebody that wants a handgun will have to go through. They'll have to file to get a license. They'll have to go to training. They'll have to go through testing, all kinds of things. And the idea is to discourage those people from getting a handgun. If you've heard the gentleman talk, Mr. McDonald, about this, he says, you know, his neighborhood was being overrun with gang members. I mean, he was terrified of this, and so he needed a pistol to protect himself. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in that that case also. Here's one I think is really interesting. You know, local police departments can team up with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service, known as ICE. And they can allow ICE to check the records, like in the local jail, and they can find illegal immigrants, and then if they have illegal immigrants, they can be deported. Immigrant advocates say that the year-old agreement between the city of Philadelphia and ICE has resulted in deportation proceedings against immigrants arrested on even minor charges. Now, what they didn't say was illegal immigrants. This comes from an immigrant support group. But the illegal immigrants are claiming they were only arrested for minor things, and then they were found out to be illegal immigrants. It's just terrible that they would be found out, and you've heard my heart on this one. Wonderful people, but we cannot sustain unlimited legal or illegal immigration anymore. And the president spoke on the topic today, and he's talking about he wants comprehensive immigration reform. And remember, the Congress walked away from that 2 years ago, and I'm suspecting they'll do the same thing before the elections this fall. Nobody wants to touch it. So very, very interesting to see what will happen on that. And I don't know if these ICE agreements, local PD agreements with Immigration and Customs Services are on the increase or they're decreasing, but seems like a good way to check people, doesn't it, if they're living here illegally. What am I looking at here? Oh, I can't talk about that story, too. It's a family show. So, yeah, this is a really a good one. I think if you have time, I'm going to try to let you listen to this particular story. I think we can get the whole thing. I'm worried about the – well, maybe I won't play it. Governor Jan Brewer in Arizona has taken on the president, and she has a little public service announcement. She's made a video that says that, you know, if you said you were going to do something about the border, we're still waiting. And the only thing he did is they put up signs that said in various places, and she's standing in front of one, and she points to it, that said, this is a dangerous area because of smuggling of drugs and firearms, or words to that effect. And in other words, illegal immigrants, this is a dangerous place because they're bringing drugs and firearms in here. But she says, we don't want the signs. We want some action on border security. I don't know if you've heard Governor Jan Brewer much, but I think she's a courageous woman to stand up the way she is, and particularly to the President of the United States. You know, nobody likes to harp on the President of the United States, but, you know, some presidents perhaps all presidents at one time or another sort of hold themselves wide open for criticism because they become so, after all, you're president of everybody, not just your party or the second major party or even minor parties. You're everybody's president, and people ought to act that way. here was an interesting one about the tasing people, and the 92-year-old, did we talk about that one last week? They were going to tase this woman. This is El Reno, Oklahoma. I used to work there. El Reno's where a very, very large federal prison is. It's a reception center for all the federal prison systems, but they were actually going to tase this woman. And she was like 92 years old, and the deal was the presence of uninvited armed strangers in her home. Mona ordered them to leave, destructive issue by a fragile female, an octogenarian, confined to a hospital-style bed and tethered to an oxygen tank, was interpreted as aggressive by Officer Tom Duran, who ordered one of his associates to tase her. Now, what in the world is wrong with somebody? I don't know the circumstance, but how much do you have to know? Unless the 92-year-old woman had a machine gun in her hand, would there be any reason in the world to tase that person? I'm a big fan of the taser. It's cut injuries and accidents to both citizens and cops down about 50% where they keep the data across the United States. But some of these tasings you can see on YouTube are just crazy. In fact, I have a student who's going to be doing a study of those. I've had one do it before. Look at about 100 of those, of these police tasings. And some of them are, the ones that get up there are the kind of the crazy ones. And, you know, you've heard my view about it. Police work's a talking business. That's the skill we ought to have in-service training on and testing and that type of thing. So sometimes you need the taser, sometimes you don't. Well, that pretty well gets us through the news. I've got tons and tons of news that I could look at. Oh, I do have to mention the Westlake, Ohio little girl who's now on the no-fly list. Can I find that? Mike, can you find me that story real quick? Yeah, she's on the no-fly list, and she gets, you know, she gets special searches and all this business, and there's virtually no reason for this to happen to this little girl. Let me see if I can find, yeah, here we are. Alyssa Thomas, 6 years old, is a little girl who's already under the spotlight of the federal government. Her family recently discovered that Alyssa is on the no-fly list maintained by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. We were like puzzled, says Dr. Santosh Thomas. I'm like, well, she's kind of 6 years old, and this is not something that should be typical. Thomas and his wife were made aware of this listing during a recent trip from Cleveland to Minneapolis. The ticket agent at the counter at Continental at Hopkins Airport in Cleveland notified the family. They said, well, she's on the list. We're like, okay, what's the story? What do we have to do to get her off the list? This isn't exactly a list that we want her to be on. The FBI in Cleveland will confirm that a list exists, but for national security reasons, they won't tell or discuss who's on the list and why. So the family was allowed to make their trip, but they were told to contact Homeland Security to clear up the matter. Alyssa just received a letter from the government notifying the six-year-old that nothing will be changed and they won't confirm nor deny any information that they had about her or someone else with the same name. She's been flying since she was 2 months old. This is six. Remember Mikey? He's the 9-year-old Cub Scout in Philadelphia that he gets checked regularly too. Oh, I love this over-reliance on, oh my gosh, TSA, that type of business. So good luck with that one. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think what we're going to do now is shift to our feature event for tonight, and that's going to be a marvelous interview by a former Solicitor General of the United States, but he'll be interviewing Joan Biskupic, B-I-S-K-U-P-I-C. We won't be able to hear all of this, but you can go to booktv.org and put in American Original, that's the title of the book, subtitles The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And I hear that pronounced 10 different ways, so the one I've just said, I've heard it that way before. But very interesting person, and we won't be able to hear it all tonight, but I'm very sympathetic with biographers. They have a tough job. They got to get it right. They get criticism of all sorts of people. Sometimes they find out they made mistakes. They have to be super accurate. And I think a Supreme Court reporter is probably going to be about as good as anybody. So give me a second to set this up, and away we go with Joan Biskupic discussing her book, American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. It's working. Don't leave.
Coming up next, Book TV presents Afterwards, an hour-long program where we invite guest hosts to interview authors. This week, Joan Disculpin, USA Today's Supreme Court correspondent, discusses her new book, American Original, a biography of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. In it, she explores the Associate Justice's colorful personality and history. The veteran legal reporter talks with former U.S. Solicitor General Ted Olson. John, you've written a book about Justice Antonin Scalia, and your title is The American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. But I was taken with the word American Original, and I think that's very apt, but I'm wondering how you came to that. Tell me about that.
That's an interesting question because you want the book to reflect the subject and what you're dealing with, but you also want a title that will urge people to pick it up and read it. And at first, my publisher and editor and I were thinking about he was called Scalia. You know, he's well known enough that you could probably get away with that. But then we thought we wanted to connote something larger because he is so much larger. And American Original, as you know, Ted, is a pun in some ways. First of all, it reflects his Italian-American story, his first-generation story, which is so much a part of this book. But the word original is tied to his legal approach of originalism, in which he looks back at what the 18th century drafters of the Constitution wanted in the document and how it should be interpreted today. So we thought that was actually, it was the product of a committee, I have to say, the title American Original, and it reflects him as an original, him as a first-generation American, and also a proponent of the originalism legal theory.
And he is an original in a way, and there's no one, I think, that's ever been like him on the Supreme Court. Is that also what you thought about?
Yes, I mean, just people say, so many people are intrigued by my choice with him because, of course, for my first biography, I did Justice Andrew Day O'Connor. He was just a pioneering individual who was such a natural as a subject. But he's, in some ways, for people who don't know the court, just one of a hand, you know, he's one of the nine. He's a conservative, certainly. He's outspoken. But why focus so much on him? Because he is an original. I mean, you know firsthand, you've been following him and being close to him for decades. He's so distinctive in his style, you know, the opera viewing with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, duck hunting with Dick Cheney. But his approach to the law and his approach to life is such a wide embrace that he is distinctive among his black robe peers.
I think of him as so robust and so full of life. You mentioned the opera. I think of Justice Scalia as someone who might have been in an opera because he is Italian, of course, that's it, and he is larger than life, and he has this corporate personality that when he is in a room, it everyone listens to him and talks to him, and that's true in the Supreme Court, too, isn't that? You talk about that in your book, about you have a whole chapter about his oral argument and what it's like to be in the Supreme Court with you.
It's funny you home right in on the opera because at one point I described him as a cross between Pavarotti and Frankfurter because you can see him almost conducting something. There were times when I go to watch him speak and he just stand up and I'm like, what's that? Because he's got this kind of showman's movement about him that's both operatic, but it's also comical, too. Justice Thomas said something to me at one point about the way Justice Scalia even composes his opinions. He said he sits down on his computer, he puts on his classical music, often opera, and he starts to conduct as if he's doing a symphony. So there is something large and operatic about him.
So you didn't think for a moment that he has four law clerks that sit down and write opinions and then he just signs the changes?
Well, as you know, he relies on his clerks to some extent for the research, but his writing style is so distinctive, so original, that he can hardly be really influenced by clerks or have clerks do his first draft. You know, Justice John Paul Stevens is another justice who does his own first draft. And that Justice Stevens says, I'll leave the bench when I stop doing my own first draft. Well, Justice Scalia is that way, too, and I think the writing shows.
I think it does, too. I mean, I love to pick up an opinion of a Justice Scalia, whether it be the most of tax or bankruptcy or the most obscure topic, and somehow he brings it to life. I mean, I think you talk about that a great deal in the book, about how somehow he's able to write. Not everybody can, law can be boring, but it's not boring when he writes. Is that right?
He's very engaged, and that's what drew me to him, is that he's engaged in his subject, and he's sort of interested in the world at large. And I found that during our conversations together, he would often respond to my questions by answering and then asking other questions, just about different ideas, different topics, different things that others had said about him.
Tell me about his biography. I mean, what made him what he is today? Tell me about his upbringing and his education.
He has an unusual life story in that not only was he an only child in this in a Catholic family, but he was the only offspring of his generation, of these two Italian-striving parents that he had. His mother came from a family of seven, but she was the only one who bore a child out of that group. His father, who had come over from Sicily, had been one of two kids, and he was the only one who had an offspring. His father was in his teens when he came here, knowing no English, very little English, and went on to earn a PhD at Columbia in Romance Languages and become a professor of Romance Languages at Brooklyn College. Very brainy sort. Family members said he was known to always have his nose in a book, really couldn't abide sewingness, set very high standards for his son, the future justice. His mother's side was much more... they were the ones who were really out there. They were full of storytellers, a family of jokesters and showmen. And there was a situation between the two parents in terms of kind of where they came from. And he sort of picked up a little bit of both. In his mother's family, they always had a piano. He learned to play the piano when he was quite young. And you know, to this day, he loves to sit down and play the piano. So here he is. His parents actually were married for about 6 or 7 years before he came along. So he was very much a wanted child and very much a doted on child of not just his parents, but of all these aunts and uncles, which I think not only made him believe that he should always be the center of attention, but also put quite a burden on him, you know, to perform. And his father was quite the quite a demanding individual. And there were a couple times in my conversations with him that the justice said that he felt like he never quite satisfied his father, which is an unusual thing to say when, you know, here he is, he went to Georgetown undergrad, he went to Harvard Law School, he's become a justice of the United States, but now his father and mother have passed away while he was still on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit and before he'd been elevated to the Supreme Court.
Did he teach law?
Yes. He taught mostly at the University of Chicago, but he also had taught a little bit at Georgetown University and also at, you're talking about the justice,
yes.
His father,
yes. Yes.
I couldn't thought of course, with a professor. Yeah. He taught at the University of Chicago mostly, but then also at Stanford for a semester and for a full calendar year, and then also at Georgetown. He liked it, but he did not get into it as much as you would have expected, because he was so brainy and intellectual, you would have thought he would have been drawn much more to teaching. But he it was easy enough for him to leave it, frankly. You know what he was really excited about? Something that you enjoyed. He really liked being in the executive branch. You know,
tell us about the executive. What was his job and what did he do?
Sure. He started in the Nixon administration, and he started with a new office created while he was there, the Office of Telecommunications Policy. And he was general counsel for that. And then he moved into more of an administrative position where he was in charge of sort of ideas to streamline the bureaucracy. His real break came when President Nixon, who was in the throes of Watergate, nominated him to be an assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel, an office you know well. And he was nominated by Richard Nixon, but was not approved until later in August of 1974, after Richard Nixon had resigned in the aftermath of Watergate. So he became essentially a Gerald Ford appointee and really cut his teeth in the wake of Watergate in the Ford administration. And his very first assignment as an assistant attorney general was to determine who owned the Watergate papers and tapes. No easy task, right, when you come into office. But his opinion on behalf of that office was that Nixon owned those tapes and other documents from these 10 years that the Congress quickly reversed that, and that's why the American public had asked.
Who did he replace as Assistant Attorney General for the office?
A man by the name of Dixon, Robert Dixon. And at the time, another person who you're very familiar with, Larry Silberman, who's gone on to become a federal appeals court judge here in Washington, D.C. Mr. Silberman was Deputy Attorney General, what his exact title was. His job was to find a new assistant for the Office of Legal Counsel, and a man by the name of John Rhodes, sort of like your life, Ted, too, because you know all these players. John Rhodes had been a long-time aide in both the Nixon and Ford administration, and he had the idea that this fellow, Antonin Scalia, who had served them well in the Office of Telecommunications Policy, might feel comfortable in this kind of crazy post-Watergate world. As John Rhodes said, you know, this was at a time when a lot of Republicans were scrambling to get out of the administration. You know, the place was imploding. People were worried about their reputation. There were all these searches going on. First of all, because of the investigations, there were all these searches for documents, for tapes, and it was kind of a difficult, chaotic time in the administration. And Mr. Silberman and Mr. Rhodes both said, you know, they were looking for someone who would not be afraid of this, who would not be, as Larry Silberman said, wimps in the face of a lot of this scrutiny.
They found the non-wimps.
Well, yeah, did they ever, really. And he, you know, came crusading in and, as I said, really cut his teeth in the wake of Watergate. And Larry Silberman says that he never was drawn to someone so immediately as he was to now Justice Scalia. And, you know, both of them, they're both quite formidable and had a good time together.
Well, I thought it was interesting also that William Rehnquist had been Assistant Attorney General under Nixon in the Office of Legal Counsel.
That's right. Now, and what you're remembering, of course, Bill Rehnquist had that job, but then he, in January of 1972, is successfully appointed to the Supreme Court. So there was a little gap between when Bill Rehnquist left the job and Antonin Scalia came into the job.
Do you think that they knew one another or related to one another?
No, they certainly knew each other, but they had not dealt with each other much. But that's interesting, you know, in talking to people like Justice John Paul Stevens, who was nominated by Gerald Ford for the Supreme Court in 75, and who had earlier been nominated by Nixon, appointed by Nixon to the Seventh Circuit. All these people sort of knew of each other, but they hadn't quite worked together. I mean, I'm talking about Justice Scalia as the core. And Justice Scalia did not meet or really vet John Paul Stevens when he was being proposed for the Supreme Court. That also to Ed Leedy, who then became the Attorney General. This is all in this post-Watergate era where, you know, the nation went through several attorneys.
Right, and there was a lot of turnover.
Right. So you can imagine, this is where Justice Scalia essentially comes of age in the administration.
Well, tell me, I interrupted you, but I wanted you to tell me a little bit about the Office of Legal Counsel. I know a little bit about
right.
it, but I think that the people watching this program would want to know, this is part of his formation. He was a professor. And then served in the administration, and then served in the Office of Legal Counsel. It's an interesting position.
It is, and the job is essentially sort of the constitutional lawyer to the president to say what's constitutional and what's not. Many of our viewers now will know of that office because that was the office that produced the torture memos that are related to what's going on now, you know, the Guantanamo detainees and various cases going forward. Other than that, though, it's the kind of office that rarely is in the headlines. It's a brainier office. It's not usually that prominent for the public, but it's very prominent among lawyers because it typically draws someone who is very much interested in the Constitution and the intellectual side of the Constitution. So it's a very good match for
a small office, produces legal opinions for the administration, including matters of constitutional law.
That's right.
In a sense, it's a pretty good training ground for a person like Bill Rehnquist or Antonin Scalia to be on the Supreme Court, because when you say they do, that office deals with a lot of things that might ultimately come before the Supreme Court.
That's right, and as head of that office, he often starred with members of Congress. He was constantly going up to testify before people like Ed Muskie, people like Father Robert Dryden, very strong liberals, who who were skeptical of what the Ford administration was doing in terms of executive privilege even back then, in terms of, you know, keeping documents secret. And boy, did he get into that. He loved that. He loved sparring with these liberals.
You think he held his own?
Oh, you know what he said? Yeah. Well, I have the transcript. So he did hold his own. But what I talked to him about that in, you know, the 3 years, he said, ah, I could have done it with one hand tied behind the back. As you know, Justice Scalia thing to say.
He's not shy. So he served in the Office of Legal Counsel. He must have left just at the end of the Ford administration.
January 1970.
And then the Carter administration came along, and then the Reagan administration came along, and then, what, about 5-6 years? Well, when was it? In the Reagan administration, President Reagan took office in January of 1981. When did they put the finger on Justice Scalia to become an appeals court judge?
Well, that's interesting. And that I just said that he left in 76, but he actually didn't leave until 77 when Jimmy Carter was sworn in. He goes to the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, and then he works his way to the University of Chicago. And actually, he wanted to go into the Reagan administration sooner than he was able. And actually, this involved somebody else you know, William Frank Smith. William Frank Smith was on the lookout for a Solicitor General. That is, as you know, because you've also held that job, it's a very important job. It's the government's top lawyer before the Supreme Court. It's your office that's imbued with lots of dignity. All the men who have held that, and have the first woman doing it, but all the men have worn, you know, the morning suit and sit, you know, with tails. It's quite a prestigious job, and also yet another intellectual kind of brain job before the court. And then Professor Scalia at the University of Chicago really wanted that job. And he saw he was going to get it. He had had what he thought was a pretty good interview with William Frank Smith, who was then Attorney General. But Rex Lee was also up for that job. And as Bill Smith writes in his memoirs that I know you are familiar with, the late Bill Smith, he said there was a really close call, but he went with Rex Lee. And that was a very big disappointment. In fact, Justice Scalia used the word bitter when he talked to me about it. I think because he came so close. And it was a job that he thought was tailor-made for him. You know,
he was
quite an advocate. And that was a real blow. Now, that came in spring of 1981. That's when Rex Lee got the job. And then the Reagan administration offered him, Justice Scalia, a job on the Seventh Circuit, which is based in Chicago. Now, he's living in Chicago at the time, but he doesn't like Chicago. It's happened to be my hometown. You know, I know you spent plenty of time in the Upper Midwest. But he and his wife, Maureen, they were plain East Coast folks. And they really did not enjoy their time in Chicago that much, and they were eager to get back to the East Coast, especially Washington. So here he is, having just lost the chance of being a Solicitor General, being offered a lifetime appointment to a prestigious court of appeals, the Seventh Circuit, based in Chicago, and he decides he's going to wait. He's going to hold out in hopes that he's going to get a job on the federal appeals court here in Washington.
Well, he really wanted
to. Because he knew, you know, his forte was administrative law, and that's what this court here in Washington, D.C. handles most of. And he's taking a chance. You know, here he had an offer in hand versus one that might not come, but it did. And just a few months later, in 1982, he was officially appointed by Ronald Reagan to the U.S. Court of Appeals to the D.C. Circuit.
So he didn't get to be Solicitor General, but he got at least, I wouldn't say second place. That the D.C. Circuit is considered to be the second highest court in the land by some people. It's equal with other circuit court, federal circuit courts, but it's in Washington, and it handles cases many of which go to the Supreme Court.
That's right. And some people would say that if he had become Solicitor General and had taken some pretty tough stands, he might never have been on death and appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Who knows? But it worked out better for him in the end.
So, 82, he goes on the D.C. Circuit.
Yes.
And then when does he get appointed to the Supreme Court?
He gets appointed in 1986. And the real battle there, inside, is whether he's going to beat Robert Bork to that nomination. As you know, Robert Bork had been really the man on deck for the Supreme Court. He had been a really strong intellectual force behind conservatism.
And a former Solicitor General.
That's right. And 9 years, Justice Scalia's senior. He was on the D.C. Circuit before Justice Scalia, and in some ways, I think people believe that it is owed to him. Now, he did have a hand in the Saturday Night Massacre during Watergate, which resulted in all the firings in the Attorney General's office, and, you know, enough controversy that he was passed up in 1975 when the Ford administration went for Justice John Paul Stevens. But here we are in the mid-'80s, and the question is, after Ronald Reagan has chosen Sandra Day O'Connor to be the first woman justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, who will he choose next? And it's false to Anthony Scalia, and I'll tell you why.
Well, he did choose four.
But not until 87.
Okay.
Which really made a big difference, because by then, the Senate had switched Democratic. And so he chooses Justice Scalia, he chooses Anthony Scalia in 86. President Reagan, as you know, was enthralled by the first generation story. He liked Anthony Scalia's, you know, Italian heritage. He certainly was a conservative equal to Robert Bork, but he presented a little bit of a different tale. And at the time, the administration didn't know whether he was going to get any more appointments. He was 86. So this is Scalia seemed a lot healthier. I remember telling that news that he was a smoker, and he said, you know, he's a smoker. Robert Bork was a smoker. We're worried about his health. So, you know, the administration goes with Anthony Scalia. He, you know, states through the process.
Well, let me stop a minute, because that vacancy was created when Chief Justice Warren Burger resigned, right?
Okay.
And then instead of going outside the court, President Reagan selected William Rehnquist, who was an associate justice, to be Chief Justice. So there was that confirmation, and then selected Scalia to take the Rehnquist seat, right? And so didn't they come sort of together at the same time?
Yes, and that also helped him. He was helped by his Italian-American heritage. He was helped by the fact that, his record was, for all intents and purposes, right there in plain sight. But there was no reason for the senators to probe too deeply into how his conservatism was. But he followed William Rehnquist's battle for Chief Justice.
That was quite a...
It was. And a lot of liberal groups came out very strong against him to be elevated to Chief. You know, they didn't like his record on the Supreme Court as being so conservative, but he also was someone who had been quite outspoken when he was an assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel. And he had a record that that generated so many more critics. So, you know, liberal senators and liberal activist groups spend all their fire on that nomination, and Bill Rehnquist is through. He becomes Chief Justice. So then here comes Anthony Scalia, who has this wonderful life story. His nine children line up behind him there.
I was going to ask you, when you mentioned before that he was an only child, it turns out he has nine children,
right.
And how many grandchildren now?
30, but I have to check. I think
Well, I asked him once, how could he remember all the names of his grandchildren? What makes you think I remember all the grandchildren? But anyway, he's one of nine, and he's got now, he has 30 grandchildren. I don't know what it was then, but here he has a wonderful life story.
Right. At the time he's nominated in 1986, he has no grandchildren. His kids are all, they all line up behind him. They look lovely. The senators are constantly talking as they, even the Democrats, oh, you're so lovely. Everything's wonderful. And he is so confident in his views, he only answers what he wants to answer. And he himself knows that he can't go down any path that could be controversial, and he's been given lots of advice by his handlers in the Reagan administration and close friends to not say anything. And Arlen Specter was so frustrated, the then Republican senator from Pennsylvania, was so frustrated during the nomination hearing that he then writes in his own book about how, I don't think I could have gotten even the name right and serial number out of the guy. And how he just played that committee in so many ways, and
I was going to say, he not just the committee, it wasn't the vote on the...
98-0.
So now we know there's been all these contentious votes for Justice Sotomayor, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Robert Bork a couple years later, maybe the next year, you'll tell me, goes down in flames in the confirmation process. And Justice Scalia, one of the more controversial justices and more colorful and more flamboyant, most flamboyant, 98-0.
Yeah, and but you know what, Ted? This is some of the dialogue, even from the hardline liberals. Howard Nussbaum opens his conversation, his questions, his probing, by saying, it's a thing that beat me in squash the other day. There was a very good old boy thing going on. And in fact, you probably remember in the book, I opened with Justice Scalia even talking about the first softball question from
Senator,
when he was before the Federal Society, and the justice himself put his arms together as if bring them on, you know. And I think we had a good time. In fact, at the end of the series, he said, I have truly enjoyed myself. And what I write was, I think you did.
I think you did, too. Yeah. And you have some great stories in the book about, for example, Senator Spector asked an oddball question about, we won't have enough time here, but oddball question about real property laws bringing you to you know, some real, and then Justice Scalia, without a pause, tells this great story about two lawyers in New York that attacked each other.
He hijacked the question. And that happens throughout. He hijacks the question, gives his own answer, and then it's like, okay, we're out of time. And you know, later I asked Justice Scalia about that complaint of Senator Spector's about how he sort of, you know, shifted the question to answer what he wanted to answer. And I said, did you think he was a real answer to the question? He said, who knows? Well, probably not.
And he said, by the time Justice Scalia got finished with his answer, he had forgotten what the question
was.
Yeah,
the senator did. Yes, right.
So now, how did Justice Scalia, he is so outgoing in his opinion, blunt, sometimes pretty rough, would you say, in the dissenting opinions or even the opinions that he writes challenging the views of his colleagues? How does he get along with his colleagues? I'm going to ask you more about the opinions, but what is their relationship like? I mean, that's going to be pretty tough stuff.
Well, initially, there's a great story about Justice Powell and Marshall saying during oral arguments, because he didn't realize that the rest of us are here. He's so such to dominate oral arguments. And, you know, this is a time when the bench is going to be quiet.
Well, as I mentioned, we're not going to be able to hear all of that because it goes more than an hour, but what an interesting character. Can you imagine trying to keep track of 30 grandchildren? That is really something. But, you know, you take all the lawyers in the United States, and we have certainly our share of the world, and the largest per capita, I believe, safely. And nine of them end up on the United States Supreme Court. And it's a long climb to get there, and they come by various circuitous routes. And he sounds like a very interesting gentleman, and I've always enjoyed his commentary, and I think everyone does. Politics, society is a pretty staunch conservative, but people on the other end appreciate him the same way. Well, that's pretty much it for tonight. I think we're going to have Vera Lynn take us out and take a look on the billing and see what's going on next week, and we'll see you. We'll be meeting again.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Smiling, just like you always do, till the blue skies rise with your clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.